Welcome to the Leadership Window Podcast with Patrick Jinks. Each week, through a social sector lens, Patrick interviews leaders and experts and puts us in touch with trends and tips for leading effectively. Patrick is an LSI certified leadership coach, a member of the Forbes Coaches Council, a best-selling author, award-winning photographer, and professional speaker. And now, here's Patrick.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to episode 37 of The Leadership Window. I am Patrick Jinks, leadership and strategy coach and president of The Jinks Perspective. Glad you are along for this episode. Got a good friend and colleague and peer and friend and friend and friend. I think that's probably the best way I can describe our guest today. Monroe Free is the president and CEO of Habitat for Humanity of Greenville County. And if anyone leads with heart, this guy does. But we are going to catch up with him in just a moment. Before we get rolling, we want you to hear a brief message from the sponsor of this podcast, Leadership Systems Incorporated.
Hey, this is Michael Wallace with Leadership Systems Incorporated. And on behalf of LSI, I want to say thanks for supporting our friend Patrick Jinks and the Leadership Window Podcast. We've been partnering with Patrick for many years, and we are so proud to have him represent us as an LSI certified executive coach. As a mutual friend, we'd like to offer you exclusive rates on some of the same training that Patrick has received over the years, as well as some new experiences that we've been developing. Head over to leadershipsystems.com/jinks to see the upcoming training events on our calendar and register today to keep learning and growing. Again, that's leadershipsystems.com/jinks, J-I-N-K-S, for exclusive pricing on LSI's virtual and in-person training events. Thanks a lot.
We appreciate our partners at Leadership Systems, and if you want to learn how to apply a coaching toolkit to your management repertoire, LSI, those are the people that you call. They've got a full-on rigorous coaching certification program, but even if you just want to go through an introductory course in the coaching model to be a better manager and leader, they've got it all from every level that you want. So check them out at leadershipsystems.com. Monroe Free is with us today, and as I mentioned, he's the president and CEO for Habitat for Humanity of Greenville County, South Carolina. And we've had some folks from Greenville, and because South Carolina is my home state, we do a lot of South Carolina podcast content on this show. Greenville is, I haven't lived in other places. I live in Columbia. I have worked across the state. I don't know that there's a more active and engaged nonprofit community than Greenville, South Carolina. It is really incredible. And part of what makes it so is Habitat for Humanity. They are just an amazing organization. They're a household name. You've heard about them. You probably know who they are. And I would truly say, with or without Monroe here in the studio with me, that this local affiliate in Greenville is really one of the leading Habitat for Humanities. I mean, they have taught me so much about how much more Habitat is doing than what most people think and realize. You know, there are jobs, and then there are careers, there are vocations, and then there are callings. And I think Monroe is where he is, not because it was a job opportunity, but this is truly a calling for him. Before he was running Habitat for Humanity in Greenville, he did lots of other ministerial types of nonprofit work, from running Knox Area Rescue Ministries and the Christian Community Foundation of Knoxville, Tennessee. He worked for the Christian Blind Mission. He's been on tons of boards. Today, at this moment, he is chairing the board of our state's nonprofit association, which is called Together SC, among lots of other things. He is leading with head and heart. And because that is the person I know him to be, I thought that's what we'd make this particular episode about. So, Monroe, welcome. Thanks for being here, man.
Thank you, Patrick. It's an honor and a joy. to be with you. I would agree with your assessment from earlier. Among all the different relationships we have, friend is the most important and the most highly valued. I appreciate you having me here.
Well, I appreciate you. You know, it started out, we just kind of knew each other. We passed each other in the hallway at things like the Together SC Summit, where you were presenting and I was presenting, and we kind of knew who each other were. And then you had a need in your organization and reached out to us to step in and partner with you on a number of things with strategy and board and your team. And so then your organization became, you know, formally a client, and I guess formally and technically I became sort of a vendor. And it didn't take, but I think just a couple of interactions with each other, we became tight. I think we just kindred spirits and just a strong affinity for the things that we're working on. And it's just developed into one of the richest relationships I have in my life right now, Monroe. I mean that.
Well, I appreciate that. And I feel the same way. We share philosophy, but we also share bourbon and somewhere in between there, it works out pretty well for me.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's a good combination, actually. It really is.
Yes.
Monroe, tell us a little, you know, I just mentioned for a second that Habitat's doing things that most people probably don't know or realize. I think that's true about a lot of the household brand name. You know, the Goodwill Industries is far more than what a lot of people, I think, realize they are. United Way certainly has changed. Red Cross, man, far more than what you just sort of, if you just have this peripheral view of these brand name nonprofits. And I don't mean to just, you know, lump you into a bunch of other organizations, but I think there's a similar dynamic there where there is a whole lot more than meets the eye, and a reason that these organizations have achieved the kind of status that they have. And it's because there's more than meets the eye. Tell us a little bit about Habitat for Humanity and maybe some of the core work that most people may not really know about.
Yeah, I think what we're famous for, besides Jimmy Carter, we're famous for building new houses and providing zero interest mortgage to families with low income. And we do that. But the truth is, in terms of our service delivery, the greater number of families we serve are in what we would call home preservation. And so home preservation includes repair work and weatherization work and enabling people to sustain home ownership. And in Greenville, you know, we serve four or five times the number of families in home preservation than we do in new homes. The other thing I think that most people really don't understand is that the bulk of our work with families who become homeowners is way before they become homeowners. The typical families in our program for about 18 months before they ever become homeowners, and they're going to classes, in our case, 26 hours a classroom. They're working with housing counselors individually for more hours than that, trying to make sure that they can be successful, giving them the tools they need to be successful as homeowners. You know, we feel like the worst thing we can do is set somebody up to fail. And so we want to make sure they've got the tools, and that's what that early experience with us does. And then the other thing I think is most exciting that we've started doing is community development work, where we don't just work with families, but we work with neighborhoods and with communities to try to help them reach their goals and their aspirations as a community. And it's rooted in a belief that healthy communities create healthy families. And healthy families produce healthy children. So we really believe that it's important for us to not just help a family, but help those neighbors of that family. So, for instance, today we're part of a project, literally today, in Simpsonville, South Carolina, where we'll start building a new neighborhood in the next couple of months. And we're there doing a community cleanup where we're walking through and picking up trash and trimming bushes and doing all those kinds of things, just because it will make the neighborhood stronger. And we're pulling those neighbors together to be part of that. So community development work has become a central part of who we are, and some way a kind of a collective philosophy around for all the things we do, and most people don't know that, and I guess that's okay. But Habitat takes a lot broader approach than most people imagine.
I know more than the average citizen probably, because I have done work with you and around your strategic plan. And that's one of the things that struck me and that I learned about Habitat is the sense of community and the idea that a home is more than a house. Yeah. Now it's obviously a core part of it, but you know, as you were talking about the community in the neighborhood, for some reason this came back to mind, and I don't know if I've ever told you this story, but Dr. Felton Earls was a, I don't know what he's doing now, but this was, I probably learned of this, 20 years ago, maybe. Mark O'Connell was the CEO of the United Way in Atlanta, Georgia, and was one of the big system United Way leaders. And he talked about this at a conference. He talked about a study done by Dr. Felton Earls, a sociology professor and researcher out of Harvard, I'm pretty sure. And he did I think it was a 10-year study of, like, I don't know, hundreds, if not thousands, of blocks of neighborhoods in Chicago. And his study was measuring the relationship. It was about the dynamics of crime. And they noted that there were two core commonalities among neighborhoods of high crime.
Yeah.
And it was surprising. And this was the sort of crux of his message. Number one was concentrated poverty.
Yep.
Number two, lack of neighbor to neighbor engagement.
That's right.
And he did this little test. He said, close your eyes. I've repeated this test many times and I have failed this test. close your eyes. Picture, he goes, now I know some of you live out in the middle of nowhere on a farm somewhere, you know, so, you know, take this with a grain of salt, but most of us live in some kind of a neighborhood. Yep. He said, in your mind's eye, walk out of your front door and stay facing outward on your front porch. Okay. And look across the street at the six houses across the street. Can you picture the houses? And do you know who lives in each of those six houses? Now look to your left, to the same side of the street, to the houses on your left, three houses. Do you know them? Can you picture the houses? Do you know, can you tell me today what cars are in the driveway? Go to the right, three houses. So 12 houses in all, six across the street, six, three and three on either side. And then, you know, he says, now, you know, I'm not asking for show of hands or anything, but now, if you can picture the houses and you know who lives there, here's the next question. Do you know the names and the ages of their children?
Yep.
And then he got real, real. He said, have those children ever heard you call them by their name?
Wow.
Yeah. You know, you just start to think about this stuff. And I remember as a kid, yeah, I think we had that.
Yeah, we did.
As I got older, I don't know about most people. I can't judge for, it seems to me that most people don't have that. I'll put it this way. Most of the people in that room could not pass that test.
Oh yeah. Yeah, exactly. And I couldn't at the moment, not with all three of questions. I could probably pass on the first one, but after that, but you know, it's interesting you say that, because when I was a kid, my mom and dad went on some kind of business trip, one of my dad's business trips. And, they left my sisters in charge of me, which was a fairly significant error on their part. But we lived on Highway 90 in Florida, which was the main highway all the way through Florida at that time that I-10 replaced. And it was a 4-lane. And my mom and dad gave me one instruction. Do not cross Highway 90. Well, so you know what happened. That's like saying yeah, something to a dog, right? So. Sure enough, I had a buddy who lived across the street, across Highway 90, excuse me, and I went across to play with him, and I looked both ways, made sure no cars were coming, nobody could see me, right? So I snuck back across. Mom and dad got back in town a couple of days later, got out of the car. First question my mother asked me, was why did you cross Highway 9?
Not, I thought you were going to say, did you? Why did you?
And I said, well, yeah, I did. But how do you know this, Mom? And she said, well, we stopped to get gas when we came back in town, and one of the neighbors was there, and they saw you cross Highway 9. Oh. There was a sense of responsibility that everybody had for everybody. And that's what made a community strong in many ways. Everybody had that sense of ownership. Everybody's everybody's.
And we
try to develop that some as much as we can in Habitat neighborhoods. And we see some of that. You know, the moms tell us about how they have figured out how to do a shared child care. So that, you know, one of them may work nights, one of them may work days, and they find ways to take care of each other's kids and those kinds of things. But you got to be intentional about that. And we try to be on the front end with our families and teach them how to be neighbors in that way. And because that's what produces health.
That is
how it happens. And it's interesting, Patrick, you know, you know this because you work with us, but we survey our families, research our families real regularly, use Clemson University and various ways to do that. And one of the things we found out a couple of years ago that over 90% of our families who reported to us, who responded, 92% of them said they had voted in the last election. Find another neighborhood in America where that happens. I mean, there's just overwhelming research about home ownership, but where the civic responsibility in those neighborhoods is so much higher, and we see that with our families. It's pretty amazing.
Yeah, it really is. And, you know, one of the things that strikes me and I think is would be relevant for people listening to this conversation is I've done a lot of thinking, I guess, for a number of years now about leadership from an individual and leadership from an organization. And Habitat for Humanity, at least in Greenville County, is a leadership organization in my view. I think you strive to have it be a leader in the community. But I'd love to hear your take on what that looks like to you. So for example, I remember when we were working with you on your strategic plan that we talked about the fact that affordable housing is certainly a big term in a lot of communities. It's a big deal in Greenville too. There's lots of need. Habitat's space in advancing and advocating for affordable housing accessibility is through the lens of ownership.
Yep.
So there are rentals and there are, you know, all the different sort of governmental programs and all that. Your space is, look, we know there's lots of solutions. One big one we know works is home ownership.
Right.
And so here's our space in it, and here's why you should support it and champion it with us. So two questions for you on that. What is it about home ownership? You're already touching on a little bit of it, but what is it about home ownership that creates a more healthy situation for a family than renting? And secondly, talk a little bit about the leadership nature of an organization and what it requires to be a leadership organization in a community.
Yeah, Patrick, those are great questions. And I would first say that let's take an issue in our culture, racial equity. When you look at racial equity, one of the fundamental contributors to inequity racially in our culture has to do with home ownership, because for so many years there were policies, practices, but more policies that prevented minority populations, African American people in particular, from becoming homeowners. And so now what we face is a situation where African Americans have 10% of the wealth that on average as white families. So there's this huge inequity. And what does that mean? That means things like financial security through generations, that means that wealth didn't get passed along. And bills were accumulated because they had to pay for higher education. They had to borrow money for higher education, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And so home ownership has a way of leveling the playing field some, because everybody can develop wealth through that, through equity. That's part of my response, that the fundamental difference in affordable home ownership as a strategy for affordable housing is that it enables families to develop an asset, is to develop wealth. And so our families, most of our families actually live in their home and forever, pay off their mortgage. And we have many who pay off their mortgage every year now. And they have an asset.
Yeah.
150, 170. In fact, one of our families just sold one of their homes. They walked away with $168,000 worth of equity in a 1,100 square foot house. I mean, that's great news, right? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. That's just great news for our families. And so level playing field, I should say, that ability to develop wealth, to develop an asset that provides a deep sense of security.
That's such a perfect, clear, simple picture that I don't think a lot of people think about, because not only is it now an asset for that family that's living in it, but now they have something to pass on, and that something is not debt. You know, they're not passing on this mortgage, you know, this
that's right,
this incredible debt. And so that's where you're talking about the generational aspect of it.
Some of the most moving moments at Habitat for me, I remember so distinctly the first time it happened. When I asked a simple question, why do you want to be a homeowner? And her response was, I want to pass this on to my kids.
Yeah.
It was just that simple.
It is that simple. Yeah,
but that's just, for our families, that's such a powerful emotion. And for me, I kind of take that for granted.
Yeah.
But for families who have low incomes, families who are poor, they don't get to take that for granted.
Yeah. No, that's right. Listen, it's just getting there in our family.
Yeah.
My father was the son of a sharecropper.
Yeah.
The first home he owned that I know of was the last one he lived in.
Yeah.
And he left it heavy in debt, you know, and my dad worked hard, and he came a long way from where his father was, and who had come a long way from where his father was, for sure. Yeah. And, you know, here I am, we'll have a home to leave our children.
Yes.
You know, we'll have a debt-free home. Now, what they want to do, it's up to them, but it's an asset. It's not something they've got to deal with in terms of a debt. So that's incredible.
Home ownership was the driver in that.
Yeah, that's right.
It was the driver in that. And then, you know, I've talked to so many Habitat families who tell me I'm the first person in my family to ever own a home.
That's so awesome.
I mean, it is incredible. And then I have families who say, my son's going to be the first person to ever go to college in our family. Mm. You know, you may have seen this. We just had a family that's a Habitat homeowner, and the son just got accepted into Clemson with a full ride, going to be an engineer. You know, first person ever in the family to go to college. That happened because they developed a sense of security, a safety, a financial security. Mom was able to invest in those families. I went to get my hair cut, and I went into one of those quick walk-in places, you know, a fast clip or whatever it's called. And as I walked in, a Habitat mother from across the room saw me, and she was cutting hair there, and she ran over to me, "Hey, Mr. Monroe," and so we stood and talked a minute, and I said, "Well, tell me what's different about your life in the last year that since you became a Habitat homeowner." She says, "Oh, Monroe, it's so much different." She says, "I don't have to work three jobs anymore." She said, "I get to spend time with my kids because I don't have to work but one job to make my house payment and pay our bills." And, you know, you look at 20% of people in our country pay over 50% of their income on housing. You ain't got time. You probably do have to work a second job so you can buy groceries, or a third job so you can pay medical bills. And she said, you know, I get to work one job now, so that means I get to invest in my kids. Yeah, that's pretty rich. That's pretty rich.
Well, this is what I love about you, Monroe, is we can sit and talk strategy and metrics and framework and the job and the management. And every time we do, you start telling about the families that you're, I can tell this is why you get up every day and are inspired to get to work. And it's not because, you know, you've got this, you know, great strategic plan that you and the board have. It's because you see what the impact is and it means something to you. And this is kind of the.
Well, Patrick, I would like to think I'd do this. I would do this even if I didn't get paid. I doubt that's true, but I really, that's what drives me. The families, the transformation that happens in those families, and get to thinking when I lay down every night that I got to be a little bit of a part of that.
I think you would do it if you didn't need to be paid. Maybe that's the way to say it, but yeah, I agree. I think you would. I think you would.
I think I would. If I won the lottery, my wife asked me, Kim asked me sometimes, so what would you do if we won the lottery? I said, I'd get up and go to work the next day.
Yeah.
I'd like to think that's true. You asked me a second part of that question about leadership, and I think the leadership issue around that as an organization is related to the family stories. I think leadership in the community around affordable housing means that we defend the honor of families who need affordable housing, that we are their voice and public policy, that we express the views, the perspectives that will be most helpful for them. And it's things as simple right now. We've been wrestling with one for a couple of years where our families in Greenville's been growing so fast, our families can afford the mortgage, can't afford the taxes. So how do we help those families with low income? How do we help them so that they can afford the taxes? So we've been working to see if we can get some bills passed so that they have to pay less tax than perhaps somebody who's making a more reasonable income. So that's what leadership, I think, in the community looks like, is we set the pattern. One of the things I'm really proud of, we believe that mixed income and mixed use neighborhoods are healthiest. And so it's not enough to just go build 60 homes and put all Habitat families in there. Let's have some mixed use and some mixed income, some rentals and home ownership. Let's have some families who are making over 80% of the AMI and people who are making under 80%. Let's mix all that up. And so, you know, three years ago, we put together a development in a very low income, difficult neighborhood. We brought in another organization, Homes of Hope, a great, they do rental housing primarily for low income. And we brought them in and we did a mixed use neighborhood where they actually put in 10 units of rental housing because that's what made sense. And we put in six affordable home ownership units and created this really nice little pocket neighborhood. And we said then to the community, this is how we got to do it. Mm-hmm. This is us all working together, asking a neighborhood what's the best thing for them, what do they really need, responding to their need as a community. And the city was involved in that, and two organizations, a church gave us the land, actually, that we brought all that together to set a new model of how our community can approach affordable housing. I think that's what leadership looks like. Let's show a new pattern. Let's try something different.
I do too. And, you know, I'm in the middle of a doctoral dissertation and study right now on nonprofit mission measurement. and the impact that nonprofits have against their mission. So we have our stated mission, you know, whatever that might be, you know, end homelessness or prepare children for school. And what I found in the research affirms what I believed and kind of saw in my, you know, 25 years in the nonprofit sector, which is the stories and the cases that are the most powerful, making the most impact, are hardly ever, if ever, the result of a single organization's work.
I can believe that.
It's just when you look at communities that have the great cases of impact of how, you know, they changed the game for homelessness, or we saw it in Lancaster, Pennsylvania. They built a 10-year plan to end homelessness. Well, it wasn't United Way that ended homelessness, and it wasn't the homeless shelters that United Way funded, and it wasn't the it was all of it combined. It was HUD money. It was the local continuum of care. It was the county government. It was the economic developers and so the leadership part of it that you're describing to me is that distributed leadership where you co-create solutions. This you explained with Homes of Hope.
Homes of Hope, yeah.
You know, that wasn't Habitat going in and saying, no, rental's not how you, this isn't how you do it. Habitat's got the answer. That was not how you did it. And, you know, you told me something, I don't know if you'll remember this, at lunch one day, maybe 2 years ago now, you told me that as a coach and a business, that, because I asked you for this, I said, what counsel do you have for me? And you said, not that you do this, because I don't think you do, but my sort of caution would be, don't get stuck on a system that you say, this is the system that works. Because I have a coaching system. I have a strategic planning system. I have a Habitat has a system, but you practiced it. You didn't get stuck on your system and come into a community and say, no, it's our system. You co-created the one that needed to happen there.
Yeah.
I just think that's beautiful. It's example after example of how you're living that.
I hope so, Patrick. That's certainly who I aspire to be and who Habitat and Greenville aspires to be. I think, you know, there's a lot of talk about servant leadership these, you know, over the last 10 or 15 years. You know, everybody talks about servant leadership and what it looks like. And for me, what that looks like is that you set your power aside sometimes. You say, you know what, I don't get to dictate here. I got to be part of a larger equation. I got to be part of a larger movement. And so I submit my perspectives. I submit my biases to the greater
group. Self-interest.
Yeah, to self-interest. That's a great word. That's probably the right word, actually. To the group, to do what's best for the community. And I'm going to tell you, that's hard sometimes. And it tests my ego sometimes, and it hurts. My feelings get hurt sometimes because of it. But it's still the right thing to do. And when I look back and say, gosh, we accomplished a lot more together than we could have ever accomplished separately.
Yeah, just beautiful. You are someone who leads from a deep sense of purpose as well, Monroe. And I'd like to open up some thinking, get your stream of consciousness on a couple more questions that are related, and they're around the why. And I think my first question for you is, what is your why? I mean, when I introduced you, I talked about all the ministerial kinds of work that you've spent your life engaged in, and the fact that this is a calling, and here you are at Habitat doing all these great things. So I'd like to hear a little bit about where that comes from. But I'd also like to hear a little bit then about how you engage others in understanding and connecting to the why, because you do it in your organization and you have to do it in your community. Yeah. There's a personal why, and then there's how do you communicate the why and get others to really understand and embrace it. So I'd love to just get your thoughts on that.
Well, I really do appreciate the question. And it's as you and I've talked, it's highly personal and I'll share that, my dad, came back from Second World War as an alcoholic, did not live a very exemplary life, and had a radical transformation, through a conversion to Christianity. He became a Baptist preacher, went from alcoholic to Baptist preacher in a fairly short amount of time. Dad never forgot where he came from, and he had a deep sensitivity to people who were in need, people who were hurting. The myth of our family, the central myth of our family, and I use myth in the largest sense of the word, the central myth of our family is my dad's transformation. That if my dad could have that kind of radical transformation and head in a completely different direction, that was possible for anybody. And then they're developed to a kind of a theological underpinning of that for sure. But that myth, that story, that narrative of our family became so central. When I was about, I don't know, third grade or so, we were living on Highway 90, as I mentioned earlier, and a family was traveling from Texas to South Florida, and they stopped in front of our house because we lived beside the church. And they asked my mom and dad for help. I was standing in the kitchen, and my mom and dad were in the kitchen talking with the parents who had stopped. And I heard the mother tell my mother, "If you will feed my other three kids, I'll give you my baby." And I remember that so distinctly as a 7, 8-year-old, whatever I was, and thinking then in a very immature way, the people shouldn't have to live like that. And they shouldn't have to live like that. They shouldn't have to make those kind of choices. But my early life was around, I mean, my dad did that kind of stuff and worked with families and showed up at the rescue mission and all that as part of what he saw as his ministry. I think that's probably the influence more than anything else. That's the why more than anything else. I'm still living out of that narrative. I did develop. I thought I would be a preacher. Found out that the church wasn't a very good fit for me. I because the church told me they weren't a very good fit for me.
They told me so.
But I do. For me, it's so. That the God stuff is so central to who I am and how I live my life. Mm-hmm. Now that's changed dramatically over the years. When I was younger, it was very legalistic and it was not very healthy in many ways. As I've gotten older, it's become more grace-filled and more out of a sense of love and loyalty than out of a sense of a duty or legalism. It still has its roots there. But, you know, I've done it enough now, Patrick. I've been doing this for 30 some years. I have enough stories of my own that are like my dad's. You know, I've sat with a lady who told me, you know, I came to Habitat to build a home. What I built is my character. And she talked about the transformation that has happened with her. I have the stories. I have a guy that I worked with in a homeless shelter, you know, 20 years ago that I still hear from. And he's got a family now and he's done very well in life. And I get to hear, I've had enough of that firsthand existential experience of people changing. And I was a part of an organization that was a part of that. Life just doesn't get better than that. It just doesn't get better than that. So the why is I'm looking for my, I'm looking for the next transformation. I want to see the next person that God's going to say, okay, I'm going to drop my grace on you and it is going to change everything about you.
Wow. I think we need to do another episode of just the stories. Like, let's just dig into these stories. They're powerful. They really do bring home the point. The mission for Habitat for Humanity of Greenville County says this: seeking to put God's love into action, Habitat for Humanity brings people together to build homes, communities, and hope. Mm-hmm. So the reason I pulled that mission up just now on my computer was that we didn't plan this. But you just gave a perfect example of living out the mission. You just talked about the foundation of the godliness that is your work,
yeah,
which is in the mission of Habitat.
It is.
No wonder it resonates with you and aligns with your work. And you also said, when you told the story just now about the woman who said she came to build houses and she built her character, yeah, the mission of Habitat is to build homes, but also to build communities and to build hope.
Yep.
And that's just incredible to me. Just as you're talking the mission, and I know you're not just doing that because you're trying to come up with sound bites around the mission. I know you're not, because I know you. This also strikes me. To me, and I've changed my perspective, the Jinx perspective has changed on this. Even since I wrote my book, right? Yeah. I've got the book Strategic Fail, which is why nonprofit strategic planning fails and how to fix it. And I wish I could take it back and rewrite it. I probably should do a second edition, and I've thought of it, but I've changed my stance on mission and vision since I wrote it. Everyone always thinks the mission is the purpose or the why. It's not. It's the what. It's the charge.
Yes.
The vision is the why. And your vision is a world where everyone has a decent place to live. And your why happened to you when you were 7 or 8 years old, when you said nobody should have to live like.
That's right.
Everyone should have a decent life.
Yes.
It's decent. We're not talking about Taj Mahal. We're talking about decent.
Yes.
Everybody should have dignity.
Yes.
And a decent life. I don't know. Just struck me, Monroe. I'm just because I'm tied with your strategic plan and you know, have some intimate knowledge of it. I'm sitting here listening to you talking, going, man, this is aligned.
Yeah,
and that's what it takes to me for organizational leadership.
Well, I do agree. And Patrick, I want to talk about the way I've changed through the years and think that the whole idea, and one of the reasons I love being a part of Habitat, is that idea to share the love of God. That's at the root of who I am. But you know, what we mean by that is to spread our arms as wide as possible and embrace everyone. We don't care. We don't care if you want to volunteer, if you want to be a homeowner through us. We don't care whether you're, in fact, on a bill site one day, I watched our volunteers. There was a Jewish gentleman. There was a lady who was Muslim. There was young black males. There were older white males. All this group, and they were all working there together. We don't ask that question. We don't ask what you believe or anything else. We say, come on, our arms are open. We want to embrace you. For us, that's what it means to share the love of God. And that is at the heart of who I am, what I believe, and what drives me really is. And anyway, I
love that, because, you know, I mean, there's a, you know, our country obviously is in turmoil. And there's a lot of division around the ideals of the country. I like to think of it like this. I definitely consider myself patriotic and you know, relatively conservative. I think I would have to say that. People who know me know that. Neither a Republican or a Democrat. And As much as I see wrong, that we all see wrong, that gets a lot of attention and a lot of noise, there's a lot getting done right too.
Yeah, there is.
Like what you just described to me is an example of the America that I love in actual practice.
Yes.
You know what I mean? Like there's the ideal and then there's the reality. We've talked about Ergo. Let me bring in a management tool for our listeners here. Or so Ergo is the expectation reality gap. The E stands for expectation. Yeah. The expectation, if you look at our founding documents, all men are created equal and the pursuit of life, liberty, and all these things. That's the ideal. That's the expectation. You look at the reality as a country, we haven't always lived up to that, right? And today we don't completely live up to it. So the difference between the expectation and the reality is the gap. How wide is that gap? And in places it's a gaping hole, and in other places it's not as wide as we might think.
Yeah.
We're there. You just have to practice it and have the courage to talk about it, like what you're doing here.
That's right.
I just think, though, to me, those are what you just described, where everyone's working together and this is what we're accomplishing. That's the America we want. Where we get to the place where we don't have to even say that.
Yes.
That's just the norm. That's just who, that's what America actually is.
Norm.
It's what everybody else outside of America sees in us and talks about when they talk about us.
Yes.
That's what you want.
Yes, absolutely.
That's great.
You asked me the follow-up question was something about
how do you communicate the why? Yeah.
Well, I think the way I'd answer that is that you communicate it every way you can, every time you can. We do some simple things at Habitat. We start every meeting with a look at our mission, vision, and guiding principles and talk about some aspect of that to start every meeting. And so I think there's simple, you've seen, I write something every week or 3 weeks or whatever called free thoughts, where I draw us back to mission, vision, guiding principles, where I talk about who we are and interpret kind of who we are in the world. I don't ever, as the leader, as the executive for the organization, I literally, every time we get together, that's where I start, because that's what everything else derives itself from. And I really, it's intentional, and it's daily, and it's intentional. One of the things we do several times a year in our organization is go back and ask the question of groups, why are you here? Why are we here? What is it? What is your why? So people are reminded of that, but you have to be really intentional. Patrick, there's so much work to be done. There's so much that keeps us busy. And if the leadership is not intentional about saying, okay, let's stop for a minute. Let's stop the busyness and let's reflect on why we're here, what our mission is, what our values are. If we don't do that, the second law of thermodynamics kicks in, right? It just deteriorates naturally. That's just the nature of life. And so you have to be intentional, and different people do it different ways, perhaps. But one of the things I like to do is walk around and talk to people and everybody in the organization. And, when I'm walking around and talking, I'm doing it with intention to draw them back to the mission and how they fit, how a fundraiser fits, how an accounting person fits into the overall mission. But it only happens with intention. It only happens with intention.
Well, there is, you've got years of practice and experience to back that up. And there's also lots of research to back that up. Mm-hmm. Mission valence is something that there's a lot of research on, self-determination theory. People are People in the workplace are inspired by, are engaged by three things: a sense of autonomy, that they have control over their work, a sense of competence and mastery, that they're good at what they do, and a sense of relatedness to both the mission and the leader.
Yes.
A sense of identity. Can I identify with this mission? Do you know, you asked, you said, you know, we pause and ask, you know, why are we here? I do that, and you've seen this, I do that in my board retreats.
Yes.
As a first stage before we get to strategic planning.
Yes.
And I'll ask, why are you here? And I'll tell you, 9 out of 10, and this isn't meant to be a slam or an insult on anybody. I think it's the way we've trained ourselves as a sector to talk.
Yeah.
I'll ask the question, why are you here? And guess what they'll give me? Their mission statement. Right? To build houses, to bring people together. Why are you here? To bring people together to build homes, houses. Nope. That's not your why.
Yeah.
That's not why you're here. That's what you're doing.
Yep.
Why are you doing that?
Yeah, that's right.
And your vision says people need a decent place to live.
Yeah.
There's your why. So it's amazing how we've trained ourselves when we ask boards of nonprofits or staff, why are you here? They've learned to quote their mission statement. They always start it with this. In fact, you've seen this, Monroe. I do a little exercise called Twittergy, right? Yeah, where they have to tweet their why.
Yeah.
Not their mission. I don't ask them tweet their mission. I say, if you had 120 characters or 140 characters, I think it's Twitter. Yeah. You had 140 characters to tweet why your organization exists, go. And guess what? 9 out of 10 of them start with the word two.
Yeah.
You don't answer a why question with two. You answer a why question with what word first?
Well, because.
Because.
Yeah.
But nobody starts there.
Yeah.
If you said because, you couldn't finish it with bring people together, build, like, right? Why are you here? Because we bring people together. It doesn't make sense.
Yep.
You have to answer it with the vision. You have to answer it with... I had a wonderful conversation like this with a group. It was a domestic violence center. And I've worked with a lot of domestic violence centers. And we asked them, you know, why are you here? To provide shelter and support, right? And they went through all the normal, this is what we're supposed to say. Yeah. We're supposed to say our mission here because he asked us why we're here. But your mission's not your why. So when I got to asking them and digging a little deeper, but why are you doing that? I got some really, the room's almost teared up because somebody spoke up and said, she started with a because word. She said, because unfortunately, people hurt one another, even people they love.
Yes. Yeah.
Wow. Okay. Now we're getting close to the why here. Let's keep talking. Let's unpack this conversation. Yeah. But like you said, you have to get intentional and pause. Those deep conversations don't normally happen. It's usually fill in the blank. Mission statement, vision statement, SWOT.
Yep.
You know, website, tagline. Well,
we've told nonprofits for years that they need to think like corporate world. Yeah. My experience looking out is that so much of the corporate world started thinking like nonprofit world. They asked the reason why too.
Yeah.
And that's what's made them successful. If you look at Google even, I mean, what drives them is a why, not a what. Mm. Now, they make plenty of money too. And I'm sure that helps their feelings, but they really are driven by how they can create the world in a different way. Or you look at Apple computers, you know, Steve Jobs, where he talked about the why of I want to create a world where creativity can be unleashed. And the way you do that is through personal computing. But, you know, the why was what drove him. And I think sometimes in nonprofit world, we've given into the temptation of thinking this is what we have to be competent in what we do. Well, we do have to be competent. That's absolute. That's a given. But what has to drive us is the why.
Yeah.
And that's what makes us effective.
Yeah.
That's why the clients trust us, is because of our why. That's why the community trust us, is because of our why. And being able to articulate that enables people to gather around the why. The community leaders and community folk gather around the why, not the what, but
that's
the
right.
why.
That's right. I don't think you can say it any better than that. So Monroe, we've been all in the intersection of head and heart in this conversation, because we're talking about the heart work, the calling, the purpose, the drive, the vision, the compassion, the servant leadership. We talked about all that stuff. Mm-hmm. We've also talked about the importance of constructing the mission and the vision. And we've talked ergo, and we've talked, you know, communication. There's this head and the heart. And as much of a heart person as you are, you understand, you called me and said, we want to get our board together and look at a strategy for the next 3 years, right? Yeah. So let's get some head into this as well. Not that strategy doesn't have heart in it, but the head is, okay, we got to organize this in a way that people can refer to it, and there's a framework, and there's metrics that make good common sense, and we justify the work that we're doing, and we have our theory of change and our strategic bets, and you know, it's that business yeah. side of things. Here's my question for you. I'm not sure what my question for you is, so let me kind of see if I can get it out, and you can talk all over it that you want. I'm interested, particularly with you, because I see you as such a heart leader, but a very smart, intelligent, business thinking heart leader. Does your heart or your head ever dominate the other, ever get in the way of the other? How do you reconcile? Sometimes the heart can, you know, is a great thing, but it can lead you to places that aren't productive, maybe yeah, in business. Absolutely. And certainly if you just have the head piece, then maybe the why and the purpose and the depth of the heart and the care and the compassion, at least in the nonprofit sector, isn't there. Do you ever struggle with bringing one into alignment with the other?
That's always the struggle. That's always the struggle. Is do you fall out of balance toward the heart, or do you fall out of balance toward the head? And I think the way I answer that is yes. Sometimes you do. Sometimes there are times when it makes sense to really to fall on the side of good analysis and solid projections and good research and all that. And then there are times it's the right thing to do to follow your head. Patrick, you've heard me talk about what I see as my biggest mistake in 35 years or so of nonprofit work. We're running a ministry to the homeless, and we had a program, a medical clinic, and the county health department was 3 or 4 blocks away from us. And you know, the medical clinic was an expense drain, didn't really bring in much money. And the health department was right down the street, and clients could just go there and walk in and get free health care and all those things. And just from any objective analysis, it was the right thing to do to close that clinic and send everybody to the health department. And we did. That's exactly what we did. And what happened? The health among people who were homeless in Knoxville, Tennessee, deteriorated. And the reason was because in our health clinic, they had relationship with people they trusted. And the health department, lovely, wonderful people, but a huge bureaucracy. And a homeless person who reticent to engage, they had to walk into this big building with hundreds of people and people trying to work their processes to get people through the system, and they quit going. They just didn't take care of their health. And it was a mistake. It was made for all the right reasons, except we didn't ask the heart question. What is it that drives our health clinic? It wasn't medical care that drove our health clinic. It was trust. It was relationship.
Let me play devil's advocate.
Sure.
And let's see if we can rebuild it. Because, okay, trust doesn't pay the bills, and hope doesn't pay the bills, and feeling, you know, empathy and sympathy for people and compassion doesn't, like, you made a business decision because the business
sure
wasn't viable. So my question would be, how would a heart decision, would you not have still had to have a better head decision than the one you made? So in other words, how would you have done it? I guess from the business standpoint, it wasn't viable. And so you closed it for all the wrong reasons. And yet you consider it a mistake. Looking back, what would have changed that?
Well, I think probably we thought in a binary way. We thought either or. We thought open or close. Mm. Our health clinic or the health department. I'm
singing my music now. I love this.
And that's always binary thinking.
Yes.
Is always wrong. Even when you make the right decision, you don't open yourselves up to all your possibilities.
Yeah, yeah.
And we didn't take the blinders off. We kept binary thinking. And so we could have done a number of things. We could have developed another fundraising strategy around it.
Beautiful.
We could have developed some partnerships with the health department. Mm. We could have made the transition differently where we somehow built a bridge between us and the health department. There were just a number of programmatic things that we could have done differently that we didn't think about because we were thinking just the either or. And always is probably too big a word.
No, as I'm thinking about it. So for our listeners, you couldn't see my facial expression when Monroe said, binary is always wrong or always the wrong answer. I had this puzzled look on my face and I looked at him and I mouthed the word always. Really? Is that true? But I think I figured it out. I think you're teaching me something here. I think you may end up on the yes or no as a correct answer. I think what's wrong is to always approach it as the idea that those are the only two choices. So you can land on yes or no. In the end, it might be the right thing as long as you have first considered.
That's right.
Maybe that makes more sense.
The structure of the decision making was wrong.
Yeah, good.
Because the structure of decision making was binary.
Yeah, that's always wrong. Yeah,
that is always wrong.
Got it.
That's always wrong.
Got it. That's good.
Yeah, but that's the preacher in me likes to use words like always.
I know, and right and wrong. we've had a couple of people on this show. You know some of them, people like Charles Weathers and Ron Harvey here, who have said leadership is not about right and wrong are the wrong words. It's effective. Yeah. Is it effective leadership? Is right and wrong. Boy, first you start putting judgments and they're such subjective terms. Of course, effective is a subjective term too, but the key is, are you leading people toward a shared goal?
Yes.
And a shared why.
That's right.
As a result, man, an hour flies fast when we're having this kind of conversation. This is awesome. But I want to get to a couple of questions that I ask all my guests, Monroe. You've told me about one. Your story about your father is really moving. And so you may have stolen a little bit of your own thunder for this question, but I'm sure there are others. I like to ask my guests, because I'm always intrigued by the stories, who are one or two leaders in your early life or career that have helped shape your view and perspective on leadership? And I'll just leave it open at that.
Well, I mentioned my father, but I'd be remiss if I didn't mention my mother too, who probably there were times in her life when she could have used some medication for her obsessiveness, but she really wanted things done right and focused on getting things right. And I would be remiss if I didn't say that influenced me greatly. I still like things to be done right. Mm. So that was that. And I think about a high school baseball coach who we were very successful high school baseball program, and all of the seniors, all of us ended up going to a scholarship to play baseball. But he never talked to us once about winning or losing. He only talked to us about getting better and doing things well. That influenced me. That influenced me a great deal. Yeah, I think Martin Luther King in a unique way. Of course, I never knew Martin Luther King. I was a kid when he came to our hometown. My dad was a pastor in Albany, Georgia, and when he came, when Martin Luther King came there, and I grew, but I grew up in that culture where Dr. King was basically the enemy. But nonetheless, he influenced me a great deal, and I've read everything he's ever written. But Dr. King understood the heart piece. And he was so effective at the heart piece, probably more than anyone in recent history. But Dr. King understood the head piece too. He understood that things had to change from a policy perspective, that it wasn't enough just to change people's hearts. You had to change human behavior through the law. And he did that. And, people don't realize that when he died, he had a plan together that was around affordable housing for people who were poor. And he understood that you had to change some of the fundamental systems of our world if you were really going to change and make it a more equitable world for all people to live in. So Dr. King influenced me, God bless him, and so many ways. And there've been a lot of people through the years. I've always tried to keep some business people in my life. Clarence Kegler was the vice president of diversity at Michelin North America. He was my board chairman, and he taught me how to think about diversity differently and how to understand white privilege differently and how it played itself out. And he helped me understand how to ask questions about of myself around diversity issues so that I could see things differently. So there's always been those people who've influenced me around specific things. But so many, I just view myself as I view my leadership, I should say, as a kind of a whole bunch of people's ideas, influence that I've absorbed through the years.
Boy, Dr. King, as you were talking, I'm sitting here thinking, what a great example of this episode, head and heart. But here I think, and I'm forming this as you talk, I'm thinking about this. He was, I don't know. You're really getting my raw stream of consciousness right here. And I don't know how to phrase it, but I think what I'm thinking is he was a gifted, I mean, obviously he was a rare, was a rare breed. I mean, his ability to communicate and engage was off the charts. So we've never seen anything like it. But I think as you're talking, I might describe him as a talented heart leader who almost knew how to disguise is the wrong word, the head side.
Yes.
But he couched the head side inside the heart. Heart always led.
Yes.
Heart always led. Head was there, but it was tucked in. It was tucked inside the heart.
Yeah.
Presentation, delivery, feel, the whole authenticity was there. So in other words, I guess what I'm saying is we don't think of Dr. King. Well, we do. We think of him as an intellect, but I don't think that's how we feel him.
Yeah, that's right.
When we think Dr. King, we feel the heart.
That's exactly right. But he was a brilliant strategist.
No kidding.
He knew that the only way this thing is changing is for people to see the juxtaposition of the evil of discrimination against good, decent, honorable people.
Well, he truly made it visual.
He did.
He had us see it.
To do that, the strategy was to force that confrontation where he knew he would be mistreated. And then when he was mistreated, the vast majority of people would say, that's wrong. It was absolutely brilliant strategy.
I'd love to have 10% of that intellect, that ability. last question for you, Monroe, and I wish we had more time. This is a question I ask everybody too. If you had 20 seconds to tell the world of leaders the most important thing they should pay attention to and think about, your number one advice for all leaders, the Monroe Free paramount tenet of leadership. How would you sum it up?
I think I'd start with two words. Be authentic. Lead from who you are. And part of what I mean by that, Patrick, is people's leadership gifts are different. People lead different ways. There are people who have this gregarious personality that lead attracting people to them. There are people who lead because they're quietly sitting in a room and developing strategy. There are lots of ways to lead. Be authentic, be who you are.
That's
I think is the first thing, is the thing I would say. And part of that means getting in touch with who your why, getting in touch with who you are, why you do what you do, and operating out of that, whether you're developing strategy in your office or whether you're out front rallying the crowd, let your why, that authentic why, drive you.
Man, so good. It reminds me, and I'm going to give my good friend and colleague Charles Weathers another shout out, because he was on the show a few months ago, and one of the things he said, man, I've thought about it many times. It's stuck with me. I need to call him and tell him how much this meant to me. He said, when Patrick Jenks is on and in the authentic zone, I don't remember his exact words, but it was, I think it was similar to this. Nobody can touch him.
Yeah, that's right.
When Charles Weathers is in his authenticity and living in that, nobody can touch me. He kind of went down the line that way. And I thought that it really stuck with me, is that we do all have our unique gifts.
Yeah, that's right.
And they are God-given. And so they're God-given for a reason.
That's right.
And God-given means that's our authentic selves. So when we bring that out and embrace it, it can work wonders.
We may not have time for you to.
No, we got all the time you want.
I did a week leadership conference with Gallup poll years ago.
Oh yeah.
And it was fascinating.
Yeah. Week. They do some amazing but work.
They had this theory. I guess they still do have this theory that, people have these unique gifts and that we are at our best and we're, operating more fully when we operate from those gifts. And they told a story. They worked with the NHL, the National Hockey League. And their theory was that you go and ask all the greatest in a given field what made them successful, whatever. And they said, if they tell us they put 5 cubes of sugar in their coffee, before we go ask people, how many cubes of sugar do you put in your coffee? So they're working with the NHL to interview and discover whether the people they think are going to be the top draft picks are going to be successful.
Okay.
And so they interview Bobby Hull and, you know, all the Esposito, all those guys, those greatest hockey players. And they say what they discover is that when those guys, that the unique thing that each of them had was the puck slows down, and they would talk about how when they hit the puck, it seems like the puck will never get to the net. You know, it's kind of like what people have experienced with a car wreck, you know, where everything slows down.
Slow motion.
And so they go to interview the top draft picks, and they asked them about this experience. And they said they had this 18-year-old kid from Canada, and they were sitting and interviewing him, and they asked him about this. And they said, when they asked him, he hunched his shoulders and put his head down, and he said, who told you all about that? They said, what do you mean? He says, well, my dad told me if I ever told people that, they would tell me I was crazy. He says, but when I hit the puck sometimes, it seems like it will be forever before it gets to the net. Well, he became a number one draft pick. He was an all-pro, whatever you call it, in the NHL, all-pro the first year.
Yeah.
Made the all-star team. All of us have that. And that's what they were telling us, group of leaders, is everybody has something, some place where they are at their peak performance, operate there.
Yeah. And that you almost can't describe it.
You really can't
describe it. You know, it's
but
it's,
you feel it.
You feel it. Well, that reminds, you know, I think everybody has heard this by now, but the great Wayne Gretzky, right? Speaking of hockey, the great one, you know, when asked, because he was asked that similar question, you know, why are you some, are you faster? Are you stronger? Do you do you hit the puck harder? Are you more accurate? What is it? And yeah, I mean, I think you know his answer, and a lot of our listeners do. He said, when you grow up playing hockey, everybody wants to skate to the puck because that's where the action is. He goes, I skated to where I thought the puck was going next.
That's right.
And so what appeared to be these Jedi quick reflexes, you know, were really just anticipation. But for him, now what you that just said makes sense because it was slowing down for him.
That's right. And Bo Jackson, the, you know, football player and baseball player, he used to talk about in baseball that sometimes when the pitcher threw it, it looked like a basketball coming to him. Well, you know, I was a pretty good baseball player years ago. It never looked like a basketball. Right, sometimes it looked like a BB coming at me, but it never did. And all of us have those places. I've seen you in front of crowds, Patrick, where you're just on, and you have to feel it. The crowd feels it. You're operating in your giftedness.
Yeah, people call it the zone, the zen, the mojo, the pocket. You know, whatever it is. Yeah. Well, Bo knows.
That's right.
We know Bo knows.
That's right.
Man.
So my word is find that place and operate in it
and be authentic. Man, I love it. Monroe, I knew this was going to happen. You moved me. You touched me. You hit me. You taught me. I appreciate it. I appreciate your friendship. Appreciate your work. Boy, people just don't understand what it takes to do the kinds of things that Habitat for Humanity is doing and a million other nonprofits that are doing amazing work. It's too much behind the scenes, I think, sometimes. People don't know it, and therefore they can't recognize it. But you're making it happen, I'm honored to work with you, and to have you here at the house doing this with me is just an incredible honor. So thank you.
Great conversation.
All right, folks, lead on.